Welcome back to a new series of the Bastian Ann podcast. As this is series three, we are exploring the rule of three, where each week I ask a new guest to tell me about the three tabletop games that are most important to them. Today, I'm joined by an author, game designer, and far too familiar name to anybody that spent too much time glued to White Dwarf in the 90s. I'm honored to welcome to the show longtime Games Workshop contributor and Black Library author, Gav Thorpe. Hi, Gav.
Hello. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. How are you?
Yes, I'm pretty good. Thanks.
I apologise for the 90s reference there. I know, obviously, you've been working since then, but I think for those of us that that sort of grew up with White Dwarf, I think there's a certain intensity to those first few issues that we discovered.
And that was when I suppose I was most visible. In terms of photos in White Dwarf articles, battle reports, that sort of stuff. So, yeah, there's a lot of people associate that with me, even though, you know, I was there for some time after and stuff. Particularly towards the end, it was much more less public-facing, I guess. My name was on books things, but, you know, not actually just basically my mug in front of you every month. I mean, there were whole issues almost at times when it seemed like I'd written every article, but it wasn't true.
Those battle report photos from that era of White Dwarf are like burned into my memory. if we have time later, I've allowed myself one self-indulgent question, I'm afraid. So I'm going to be asking that at the end. I'll keep that as a little treat for the end. So obviously today you're here to talk about three games that you've chosen as like your most important games. But without giving away any of your choices, what was your sort of process for choosing three games that are important to you?
It was, things that have kind of influenced my influences in a way. Two of them, and one of them sort of like being the result of that. I guess they're three kind of different, they're almost three different eras of my life. They signaled certain different things in the way I approach stuff as well. One's an old one, one's kind of from about 20 years ago, and one's fairly new. It was tricky. I was trying to think of important games rather than just favourite games, I think. That was the thing. It was like things that had an effect that's still with me now or have changed the way I look at stuff, I guess, was the main thing.
It's interesting seeing people's choices because I've sort of seen most of the choices now for this series, and it's almost everyone I think has chosen something that was like, if not their first game, like something very foundational.
Yeah,
and I think that first one is always so sort of personal importance, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone's got, you know, it's like their first White Dwarf issue or whatever it might be. The first fantasy book they remember reading or sci-fi book or whatever it might be. There's always, for the things we're into or get into. So, well, what was that catalyst? Can you trace back, like I say, not necessarily the very first one, but, you know, what was the one that you really remember was set you down this path of genre geekdom and whatever it might be, and you know, for me, influenced a large part of my life because it's become my career and everything.
Well, yeah, brilliant. So we've teased at perhaps the first pick there. So let's move on to your choices for the rule of three. Okay, so would you like to tell us your first pick?
So my first pick is Dungeons & Dragons, and particularly the basic set, which was, I believe, revised. The one I had was revised in 1981. It's sort of like the pink box, for people to remember it. In fact, I've got it right here next to me.
Is that the Tom Mulvey one?
I think may well be. I'll open it up, in fact. Let's see. So this is a D&D... Dungeons and Dragons fantasy adventure game, basic set with introductory module. It came with a big red rule book, and we were lucky that it actually came with the Keep on the Borderlands module as well to run.
Ah, yeah.
And your polyhedral dice, which you had to use a crayon to make the numbers visible.
So is this in 1981 you picked this up?
It would have been round about, I was probably 82, I reckon, 82, 83. So it would have been about 9 or 10. So 83, 84 maybe. And it was a present. The basic rules and the expert set as well, which followed on for the higher levels, my brother and I got as a present from one of our sets of grandparents. It was kind of out of the blue, really. The interesting thing was that the person that kind of got me into gaming, I suppose, and fantasy more than anybody else was my older cousin, and it was on that side of the family. So I don't know whether there was some kind of influence from there. You know, we hadn't heard of Dungeons and Dragons. My brother's 2 years older than me, so it wasn't. It was kind of out of the blue, really. This idea of a role playing game, and so we were into games and stuff. Obviously, being people, we're around about that age. It wasn't something we'd asked for. It wasn't, but I can imagine it might have been something that if they'd spoken to my cousin or it was something my cousin had already expressed interest in. I remember playing Tunnels and Trolls and things with him, and he got me into like the Citadel stuff. He had like second edition Warhammer and what have you. So he was a big influence. But via that side of the family and the grandparents on that side, I don't know, by asking or osmosis or something, decided to buy us this D&D basic and expert set out of the blue, really. And that was, and just looking at it, and even now, it gives me shivers along the arms just to see, looking at the pictures and looking at it again. And just this, suddenly, this concept of my young mind of like a game where you just play in your imagination,
Yeah. And to be given that sort of out of the blue almost is an interesting exposure to it, really.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes, it was. And we were, and I think like maybe like a lot of people actually, we didn't actually play that much. I mean, I think my dad was nice enough. That's another interesting thing. But my dad was nice enough to run a couple of adventures for us from Keeper of the Borderlands.
Okay.
Again, sort of slightly out of the blue. I look back now, actually, and I realise my dad was a bit of a geek, but not very obviously. But it's one of those things I think about, and my mum even, to a certain extent, as I think about the books we had on the shelves and stuff like that. So it wasn't, and some of the stuff we did, and you wouldn't even necessarily think of it. I mean, he was in computing, which again was quite geeky in like the 70s, 80s and stuff. But I remember him getting a copy of Warlock of Firetop Mountain, the first fighting fantasy book, my cousin had one, and we were aware of this phenomenon. Again, another thing kind of out of the blue, like this game book idea. Obviously there was choose your own adventure, but the fighting fantasy thing. And I remember my dad just coming and it just kind of appearing on the shelf after my dad came home from work one evening, and he'd obviously been to the bookshop and bought it somewhere when he worked down in London, and it was there, and it didn't have, it's like it was a few days before I come over his meal. My brother said, "Can we play it?" Because my dad's book, sort of thing. And he was like, "Yeah, okay then." And various other bits of people, like different fantasy authors and things like that. At the time, just seemed normal. But now I'm thinking, actually, it probably wasn't that normal. A lot of people weren't necessarily reading those books, within the context of that time. So, and then I had some friends at school. So this would have been when I was in by the time I got to secondary school, really, I think, who they had older brothers who were like run D&D and stuff. So I probably only played five times, six times in total, really. But it just had a massive impact, I think, on me.
Because I think those early games, I mean, I'm speaking sort of from my own experience here, but it's something I've heard from a lot of people, is that people get like their first game, like the most commonly would be like D&D or something. And then for whatever reason, whether it's struggling to find people to play with or not feeling like comfortable doing it, that it seems like a common thread that people have this kind of slightly delayed launch, I guess, where they get their first game and they sort of pore over it and like absorb it, and they know that, and it's firing up so much in their imagination even without playing it.
Well,
it's just kind of absorbing it almost.
Absolutely, and I think there's that armchair gaming is it was a very strong feature of my teen years in particular, and also just again not to go too old man and stuff, but certainly in the pre-internet days, just trying to find a community to play. You know, so you had your friends at school, and if you were lucky, one or two of them might be kind of geeks as well. So I had, you know, my gaming through my teens was mostly miniatures based, and it was mostly I just played Epic, like Epic Space Marine and Titans from Games Workshop, but didn't actually. And I tried to introduce some fantasy role playing, and we had a few sessions and things. I remember running one fantasy role play for a couple of them for a session, and they kind of enjoyed it and stuff. But they, to this day, I'm kind of still the person that's always pushing and organising. I was the gamer, you know. I think there's enjoying games and there's being a gamer, and they're not quite the same thing.
I love that you've got this thread of trying to push role playing onto miniature gamers, which we'll get onto later, perhaps with another choice.
Well, that's true. Yes,
but I like that started earlier.
Yeah. Well, and also just pushing miniatures games onto people. We know Blood Bowl was quite good for that. I had a friend.
Well, yeah, definitely.
The two of us, we were played in an American football team together, so it was a natural in.
Cool.
This was like second edition Blood Bowl, something which was actually quite complicated, and before blocking dice, before Jervis came up with the blocking dice mechanic, made it a lot more streamlined. So we played that three or four times and stuff. But yeah, I basically had one guy that I mostly played with, and Space Hulk again was somebody. Was a game that I managed to get a couple of other people to play because, again, it's more like a board game. But yeah, and there was a lot of time spent just reading books, creating characters, imagining playing, and sitting with graph paper drawing up dungeons, you know, like, because that's what you did.
Definitely.
And again, that was another boon of my dad working for a computer. In fact, I've got sheets here. He worked for a company called Dresser, and I've got some graph paper, headed graph paper. The company he worked for, Dresser Computer Services Division. So getting graph paper was free.
I think, that's such a common theme that I hear as well. I remember my dad bringing home like giant, I remember them being giant because I was like tiny, but these giant sheets of cardboard, like corrugated cardboard, and just like drawing dungeon maps and stuff on them.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how much sort of common thread there is with these different kind of starting points that as I speak to more people about this.
I think there are jump on points. You know, we talk, you know, obviously people are joining and playing stuff all the time, but particularly with editions of games and kind of there are eras, you know, it's generational, but not necessarily like, you know, parent to child, but just like say in the 90s, Games Workshop in the 90s was a very particular thing. D&D in the 80s, and we're, you know, lots of people are feeling this. That's why there's the whole kind of Stranger Things, that real retro phenomenon, old school role play thing is really strong now, because everyone's of an age and maybe introducing their kids to it or have been and stuff that we're all, you know, and nostalgia obviously is just huge business these days. But actually also just keying into something, you know, there was a swell then, you know, although D&D started in the 70s, I think it really kind of grew and became a thing in the 80s. And obviously Advanced Dungeons & Dragons was introduced and all this kind of stuff. And then it kind of lost its way in the 90s actually. And so for a lot of people, that wasn't a big recruiting time, you know. And then again, obviously, we've got quite a resurgence over the last 10 years, the last 5 years, with internet and streamed games and all kinds of other stuff. So, you know, it's been around, but there's people that, remember that, you know, were you an AD&D player when it came out, or are you a fourth edition player? Well, maybe not many of them at all, but, you know, it's like the ones they identify with. And I do it for several games, you know. I know people that are, you know, died in the wall second edition RuneQuest players.
Sure, yeah.
You know, I've just bought all the new RuneQuest stuff because I love Glorantha and stuff. and we played campaigns of that, again, probably about 20 years ago now. But, you know, it's like, which edition of Call of Cthulhu do you play? Which, you know, or not necessarily do you play, but were you introduced with? You know, you might have carried on with, you know, as editions came up, but actually it's one of the things I always, which will come bring me round to the last thing later, but you know, I like, for my job, I worked on Warhammer for, you know, directly for 14 years, and for lots of people, I'm very associated with that. But for me, of course, I always feel like I was second generation, maybe even third generation of the people to work on that. And so, as proud as I am for the contributions and things, I've never created it from scratch in the same way that, you know, D&D was created from scratch, or Warhammer, or those kinds of things, you know, mould a new idea out of nothing, or not necessarily nothing, but, you know, those kind of epoch-defining legacies, I guess. Epoch, maybe not epoch, era, you know, maybe that's it. Yeah,
what you mean.
Yeah, exactly. too much epic fancy, right?
that's it.
So, you know, I've done lots of good stuff, but it's always been standing on the shoulders of giants type stuff, I suppose.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think it's impossible to create something brand new. I think I've kind of accepted, for myself anyway. I think you get the odd thing that seems to have sparked out of nowhere, but I think you've got to acknowledge, you've got to acknowledge that you're essentially standing on the shoulders of giants, whether you're doing that out in the open with like a new edition of something, or I think it's impossible to distance yourselves from your inspirations to some extent.
Absolutely. And the thing I often say to people when they're asking about, you know, it's like, where do you get your ideas from? How do you do? It's like, well, you can be unique, you probably can't be original.
Yes, yeah.
And there's to throw in a completely left field kind of reference here, but I'm into professional wrestling as well. I watch quite a bit of that.
Sure.
And there's a wrestler called Chris Jericho, who's very famous now.
Yeah.
And reading his autobiography, and he had a great line of, they were saying, oh, you know, who do you want to be? He's going to be the next this or that. And he said, no, I want to be the first Chris Jericho.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's the thing. So he didn't necessarily do anything that people weren't doing before, but did it in combinations, or did it in such a way that he was the first to be him. And that's what you need to be as a creator, I think. As much as you might want to be the next Tolkien or the next George R.R. Martin or whichever authors inspire you and stuff, you need to be yourself first, I think.
Mm.
And you'll never get, like I say, yeah, you can't pretend your influences aren't there. And I think recognizing them is an important part of maturing as a creator. And then so that you understand where your comfort zone is and what your go-to references and inspirations are. And sometimes going out of that, but sometimes just going with it and just going, actually, I'm trying to do something that's not me. For the sake of it, because I think there's an audience rather than because I want to do it or whatever it might be.
Yeah, the way I kind of think of it is I'd rather, above anything else, I try to be like authentic in what I'm doing.
Yes.
And I think that's
definitely,
yeah, that's a good way to go about it, because you've got to acknowledge that you are essentially built up of your influences, but that mix is going to be kind of unique in everybody, I think.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. And doing it for those, and that's the reasons, I suppose, as well, is to because you want to create something, and ultimately the person you're trying to create it for is yourself.
Yes, definitely.
You know, and you know, that's kind of, you know, you hear this a lot about inventing stuff and things in general, is like, you know, identify the gap and, you know, create something that, or identify the question and create something that answers that question and stuff. But particularly when it's like games or books or things, generally it's like, well, what do I want to play that isn't quite out there yet?
Yeah.
You know, what do I want to read that isn't quite there out there yet? You know, how do I entertain myself first and foremost, and then hope there's other people that get entertained by the same stuff?
Definitely.
And then, because otherwise you end up sort of just chasing something that's not there, really. You're just chasing other people's approval and chasing, you know, if you start, you know, there are commercial considerations, there are physical constraints to publishing, there are all sorts of other stuff that you will have to bear in mind if you're making a product or bringing something out. But you don't want to start with those, I think. Mm. You want to start with a cool idea. And quite often that idea gets very complicated and you have to strip it back or whatever. And it's one of the reasons I like going back to the, like, this pick. There's a real simplicity about the Dungeon Bash D&D basic set. That made it very approachable, which just doesn't exist. Well, it does exist because people are recreating it deliberately now. When you compare it to Dungeons & Dragons as it is now, evolved, 40 years later.
Yeah.
it's a very different beast. And I don't think you can, nostalgia aside and things, there's been lots and lots of attempts to recapture this, you know, like through and for Games Workshop and Warhammer, there was like essentially the HeroQuest moment as well. There's the HeroQuest generation, HeroQuest Space Crusade generation. So, you know, and that was part of that early 90s and then through the 90s kind of boom was quite responsible for that. And again, that's never been that HeroQuest game and moment and feel has never quite been replicated, no matter how many kind of dungeon board games released and things. None of them are HeroQuest because, A, the people making them are trying to remake HeroQuest but a bit different, or they've evolved as gamers and they're just not 11 anymore. So they want a slightly more sophisticated game, or they want a slightly different thing, or whatever it might be. You know, they're trying to recapture a moment that's impossible to recapture. And I think that's the trap of nostalgia is wanting to try and recreate something that you can't, because we're basically just all a bit old and jaded and whatever. And it's disappointing that we never get that magical feeling. You know, it's like, but I do get that magical feeling just looking at this box and this book and getting it out. And just like, and so, and that's enough for me. I don't feel the need to actually try and, I'm content with my memories of it and what it's done for me, I suppose, rather than trying to recapture it and have that again. Because you go, well, I can't have that again. You know, I'm old. I've got a kid myself. You know, I want him to have those moments for himself, I suppose. That's one of the things.
Yeah.
Become a parent. And I will be running this for him maybe within a couple of years. He's 7 now, so maybe he's very bright, 7, obviously, because he gets to play games and read a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
As the son of two geeks. so, you know, and the idea of kind of like having this, you know, it doesn't really mean anything to him, but for me, running this kind of cool dungeon crawl game that will be the first time he's kind of done something like that. It would be quite fun.
Yeah, definitely.
And I get to be vicariously relive it through him.
Well, we spoke a little bit there about not trying to create something that you think people want, but creating the thing that you want, which I suspect might lead us onto your next choice quite nicely.
Yes.
Would you like to share your second pick for your next most important game?
Yes. So my next important game is Inquisitor: Battle for the Emperor's Soul.
Ah.
Which is a game that I designed. So
you're the first person to choose. I did say that you could choose one of your own games, and so far you are the only person to take me up on that offer, which I admire.
Well, I think there's lots of important games that I could have chosen, I think.
Yeah.
Various other, but they all kind of, just to kind of flip back slide, the same grandparents that bought us Dungeons & Dragons also bought me and my brother for Easter 1 year. Another couple of Games Workshop games. In fact, they might have been slightly earlier than the D&D, which was two really old. There's basically a card game called Warlock and a really old kind of board war game called Valley of the Four Winds.
Oh, okay.
And those kind of introduced us to Games Workshop games, but they're like the box games and things like that. So I could have picked one of those. Like Valley of the Four Winds was probably one of the first kind of hex war games that I played, which was, again, was quite important. Well, there's another one called, but it's all about that period, really. And actually, the standout from that period was Dungeons & Dragons. So, you know, but basically, I've written quite a lot of games or contributed a lot to certain games and things. But Inquisitor, I wanted to pick because I think it's the one of all the stuff I've done, that's actually had the most influence on Warhammer 40,000, but also a slightly wider gaming.
Definitely.
In a way, in that, it wasn't anything new. For those that don't know, Inquisitor is basically a narrative war game. And when it was released, it was played with 54 mil scale models. So models that are basically twice as large as pretty much as your regular, so 28 millimeter Warhammer 40,000 figures. Mm. So these were large, kind of like centerpiece models. You'd only have a few. And the whole idea was that you'd chop them up and convert them and create characters. And the narrative aspect of the game, it drew in elements of role playing, but also had the sensibilities of a miniatures war game, kind of combined together. So you played out narrative scenarios, and then let your characters kind of grow and develop a storyline between your games and things. The influence for that was 54 mil gaming isn't particularly new. There was a particularly large influence from Wild West skirmish gaming in the 70s. And that was kind of introduced to me via Jervis Johnson, the designer there, he had a bunch of these kind of like, I've forgotten the name of the designers now,
not Avalon Hill, was it?
Basically, no, that was, no. These were kind of more this will come around full circle for my last choice, but these were much more, these were like little like A5, almost kind of like just stapled, call zines, of rules and stuff for Wild West Skirmish and things like that. But there's also stuff like the precursor to 140,000, like Laserburn. That was like a 28mm skirmish game. But, you know, they're a lot less rigid about the setup and the choosing your forces and all that kind of stuff. And Rogue Trader, so the first edition of 140,000 was a big influence as well. And lots of D100 tables. And again, because Rogue Trader was originally envisaged as a role-playing game and then became... a miniatures game, really. But it had lots still, like the original Warhammer did, it still had lots of that kind of skirmishy role-playing elements to it. So basically, Inquisitor was like, well, okay, let's design one of those from scratch, bearing in mind all of the stuff that came before, for 140,000, with nice large miniatures that people can spend a lot of time on and they can convert and personalize and stuff like that. So, yeah. But lots of stuff we created for it has continued to kind of echo, I suppose, through the 140,000 setting particularly, and into the other games and spheres, I suppose. I'm the proudest of, I guess.
And I think obviously you say that the influences are there, that there were other war games that were doing this sort of thing, but when you sort of imagine... I mean, this was in my kind of gap from Games Workshop. So I was very much into it in the 1990s. And I believe, was it 2000?
I think, yeah, 2000 it came.
So I think around that age, I was just starting to think, I was under the illusion that I was too cool for this sort of thing. For a brief period.
The beer in college stage.
Yeah. So I was trying to wean myself away. So I remember it coming out, but it was kind of right at the tail end for me. And you say the influences are there, but it's worth stressing that what I remember is being in like a Games Workshop, and by that point Epic was kind of, I can't remember if Epic 40,000 was still around, but if it was, it was very, very much in the background. Everything else was 28mm, and it was it felt like there was kind of a standard for Games Workshop that was kind of like, you know, Warhammer and Warhammer 40K shared a lot in common with how they play. But this, and you know, you had your skirmish things like Necromunda, but they still kind of felt derived from those big games. And this felt like something that had come out of, it kind of felt like it had come out of nowhere to someone like me who, you know, my only exposure to war games had been Games Workshop. And I imagine there was a lot of people that grew up around that time where, you know, they only really knew Games Workshop war games. And I always find it fascinating that this happened. And I mean that in a good way. I mean, like, it's so different. It's like when, you know, your favorite band releases six albums that kind of sound like that band, and then they release this weird experimental thing, and you're like, what is this? What was it like trying to get this thing made, if that's not too prying a question?
No,
to ask?
Well, it was an interesting time. I mean, I consider that the kind of like the zenith of my time at Workshop as well, in terms of what we were doing and freedom. So, you know, I've been working on Warhammer 40,000 as part, you know, mostly, and particularly third edition Warhammer 40,000. And after Inquisitor, I would go on and swap and become Warhammer Lore Master, and then I was in charge of a lot of what was happening with Warhammer from 6th edition onwards and stuff. So essentially, this was kind of my last, for quite a good long while, this was my last work in the Warhammer 40,000 universe. But there was, it was interesting you're talking about, you know, like Epic and stuff was on the back burner. So that was the thing, essentially. The release strategy was pretty straightforward, it was straightforward for a while, which was that there would be a new box game for one of the main games, Warhammer, or Warhammer 40,000, every 2 years. And then there was always an Easter game, which was called depending on the time period, was either known as like a secondary game or a specialist game, which was traditionally like Epic or Man of War or Warhammer Quest, or, you know, so the sort of game, you know, the people kind of know the sort of games they would be. And then there'd also be sort of like a big game release for the Christmases in between the new editions of 40K and Warhammer. So that was generally the idea. That it was Rick Priestley's, you know, 4-year rolling schedule, basically, which was kind of introduced in the 90s. And it's funny because the first 4 years schedule was actually 5 years. But and so that was the idea, is like we just have this turnaround of kind of big box games, which was actually turned out to be more your Necromunda and Mordheim style, much more, you know, 28 mil would sell pretty well games, would come out in the gaps between 40K and Warhammer. But the Easter slot was always a bit more, well, hey, you know, it's like, let's see what we can do. And that's where we had Battlefleet Gothic, for instance. And for me, actually, I and it's just pure coincidence, but going back to that idea of Dungeons & Dragons or the you know, Valley of the Four Winds Warlock Games Workshop game, they were bought for us for Easter presents. So I've always had just a nice, you know, it's like association with Games Workshop and games at Easter, I suppose. So basically, we had this slot for 2000 coming up. So sort of like end of 1998, probably start of 1999, games development as a whole, we all got together and we just came up with a bunch of proposals for what could go in that slot. There wasn't anything coming, you know, this was slightly before the more sophisticated kind of sales and marketing departments and all that kind of stuff that Games Workshop has now. So there wasn't any particular, and because it was the Easter slot as well, like I say, we had a lot more freedom. It wasn't like, oh, it's got to be the next Necromunda thing. It's like, yeah, it's just got, let's do something cool. So we had loads of ideas of like, some of them were just kind of crazy, like doing, was it Warhammer 46, which was actually, you know, so like a weird war, you know, well, weird war too is not, again, yeah, not that surprising. And it was, again, it was on, this was kind of on the growth, but actually doing it Warhammer style. So they're like the Chaos Powers, being around in World War II, basically.
Okay. Right.
They're revisiting Dark Future as a 10 mil mass battle game. Just like corporations fighting each other. All kinds of, just revisiting Dark Future as a, you know, a Mad Max style kind of car combat game. All these kinds of things. There was also actually some supplements for 140,000, but they were big enough that they would be big games. Like, so we ended up, you know, like in the style of City Fight, but we ended up, you know, it's like doing a boarding actions game. And one of them that we put was in this mix of probably about 10 different ideas was a 54 mil skirmish game in the mold of the old Wild West kind of style skirmish games. And that was it, really. There wasn't too much to it at that stage.
Yeah.
And this was kind of proposed to the big wigs, which was basically Rick Priestley, Alan Merritt and John Blanche as well. And they like the idea of the 54 mil miniatures. And that's the thing about Games Workshop, is whatever the idea is, as much as there's lots of games and stuff, it's still what the miniatures are comes first. And that's what they say when they say they're miniatures first company. It just means the games aren't important, but it's like, what are the cool toy soldiers going to be? And so there's a very easy hook straight away of 54 mil toy soldiers. Cool. There's just, that works. Essentially, there was a bit like the Horus Heresy and Epic and stuff, you know, needing to have kind of like, we had a very limited number of models that we could have. It was going to be about 15 models in the initial release. And so we had to come up with an idea for that would allow models to work on both sides.
Yes.
You couldn't just have like orcs versus space marines or something like that. It needed to be, and it was going to be boring anyway, but we needed something where people were kind of almost had access to the entire 15 models. And the original didn't quite work, which was having Inquisitors versus Chaos Magi. So you'd had these kind of like important, these kind of like powerful Chaos Sorcerer types and cult leaders and things, and the Inquisition hunting them down. And there'd be a few models that there'd be like, I think, 5 models like Chaos and 5 Imperial, and then there'd be 5 kind of floating models that could go between both. But there still wasn't really enough choice to give people, you know, like out of that range. So it was Rick who kind of proposed the idea that maybe it was more of an internal Inquisition thing. And he just came up with the idea of radicals and Puritans. That was just 2 phrases, but that was it.
Yeah.
And then basically I got a page briefing from Rick saying, you know, the Inquisition, this is a great chance for us to revisit the Inquisition. We haven't done anything really with them since Rogue Trader. You know, here's an idea. There's a bit about radicals who like embrace chaos and try to turn it into all that kind of stuff. So I ran with it basically. And at the same time, John Blanche was starting to create some just awesome kind of concept sketches for MAD. Under the, you know, sort of like I always describe Inquisitor as under the belly of the Imperium. It's like you've got the big armies that everyone knows from 140,000.
Yeah.
Inquisitor was all about looking what was underneath it. And not necessarily day to day. There's still kind of, it was all about the weird, outlandish, crazy stuff that was in Rogue Trader illustrations. And it was always been there as kind of part and parcel of some of the madness there, but was never going to, well, at the time, would never kind of hit the battlefield of the 41st millennium. So, and at the same time, they got some time for Alan and Michael Perry, the miniature sculptors, to just do some test figures, just in 54 mil, to see how, you know, we could make them and mold them and do multi-part models and stuff like that. So that was how it began, really. So it was always... It was a process, but actually it wasn't, it never had to be a sell, I don't think. I think just that the basic concept kind of made it work, really.
But what I like about that is what you've described about having to make sure that essentially like all of the miniatures could kind of fight each other in the narrative.
Yes.
That's kind of the classic Warhammer, or I guess any kind of war game setting, is you kind of want to make sure that whichever two armies you put on the table, it makes like some sense narratively. But it's interesting how that has kind of, that restriction has kind of made Inquisitor so interesting, because you've got these characters that are much more, and I mean, I know the whole kind of setting is like Shades of Grey, but here it's really kind of ramped up this idea that you are all, you know, probably part of the Imperium. But here's why you can still be, you know, fighting each other. And I think it makes the setting all the more interesting for that.
Yes, it was with the Inquisition in particular, because the only things that had kind of been done with it is like the Grey Knights Space Marine chapter had been kind of introduced, and there's like the Ordo Malleus. And there's been stuff in a few books Ian Watson's Inquisitor trilogy, or as it's now known, the Draco trilogy, did some stuff with the Inquisition. But it always felt slightly monolithic, like the Inquisition was a thing, and it was never meant to be. Inquisitors were supposed to be this. I mean, the you know, the archetypical Inquisitor in Rogue Trader was called Obi-Wan Sherlock Clouseau. You know, like it was obviously, but you know, there's always this element of just basically random antagonist / protagonist about the Inquisitor. Like the basic level of organization of the Inquisition is an Inquisitor. And
yes,
and they have this power and authority to do whatever they want and requisition whatever they want, and such is that power that they get to, you know, they can wield entire armies, or they can just be, you know, a lone sort of Doctor Who like character just trying to, you know, solve issues or whatever is in the back of beyond with no help whatsoever, and nobody can really question them. That's the thing as well. They have In a universe that kind of has very little agency for almost anybody, both physically it's hard to move around, but also these massively oppressive organizations control everything. You know, individual commanders and people, you know, between basically the Inquisition and the Rogue Traders, about the only people that can actually decide to go somewhere and commission the means to do so on their own without being part of some massive bureaucracy. Which is what kind of lends itself really well to the narrative of Inquisitor. Of, you know, they can get themselves involved with anything; they can be anywhere.
Sure.
And so it's about repositioning the Inquisition in that regard, so that rather than being this again part of a bureaucracy and being kind of tied down with these organizations, the Ordo Malleus and the Ordo Hereticus and the Ordo Xenos. It's like, yeah, but they're kind of clubs that some Inquisitors are part of. But actually, the idea of these factions, the idea of, you know, having recongregators and Xanthites and all these other things that were kind of made up, and some of which are more radical about, you know, some that use alien technology, some of that abhor the alien, some are much more kind of tied to the ecclesiarchy and that very traditional imperial viewpoint and stuff. And then what it needed was a core, you know, it's like, well, what was the fundamental start of the Inquisition? And that's where it kind of came up with the idea of the battle for the Emperor's soul, the idea that the Inquisitors, very at the end of the Horus Heresy, were, you know, there was a bunch of people kind of knew what was going on, sort of, and the Emperor had been put on the golden throne, and there was a bunch of people who thought that that was a bad thing, that it stopped him becoming a god and doing what he needed to do. And there's a bunch of people saying, no, it's the only thing that's going to keep him alive and keep the Imperium together. And they essentially split and go one way and go to another. And essentially from that, and then, you know, 100 years later, their followers are starting to sort of like maybe have little skirmishes with each other. And 10,000 years later, it's become this, again, this impossible to catalogue plethora of beliefs and policies, and again, individual inquisitors working against each other, but also still united in that same purpose of like doing whatever it takes to protect. And then what you protect is kind of part of your personality as well. Is it the Imperium? Is it the Emperor's body himself? Is it, you know, it's like, actually, is it just the idea of humanity? Is it whatever? You know, these things define inquisitors as much as anything else. And so this became a really rich playground, I think, for creating characters, not just within the Inquisition, but who do they recruit, who fights with them, you know. Again, the whole idea was to, apart from, well, even with the Space Marine, really, what, you know, we thought, well, we need to make a 54mm Space Marine character because it would be really popular for painters and modelers and stuff. So, but even that couldn't just be an Ultramarine or a Space Wolf. We wanted to do something different. So we came up with the idea of the Death Watch. So a whole bunch of chapters send, you know, they're specialist alien hunters that get sent to help the Inquisition for really very particularly thorny issues where, you know, you really need a Space Marine to hit something. And back then, you know, it's like you'd have an individual Death Watch or maybe a kill team of two or three of them, maybe a half a squad. Obviously, that's turned into an army now, as much as other stuff has. So, but the idea was, not to have anything that would ever actually appear on a 40k battlefield. So we had these weird arco-flagellants and cultists and, you know, tech priests, which, you know, some of them were a bit more kind of mainstream, I suppose. But also a bunch of stuff that was never meant to necessarily go outside of Inquisitor. And certainly we didn't really want anything going the other way. We didn't want any, you know, the Imperial Guard couldn't just be an Imperial Guardsman. It was like, it was a Gland War veteran, or it was like some guy, you know, half bionic veteran of such and such campaign. And again, it's all about character and exceptionality, being, or exceptionalism, I suppose, rather than just being another Guardsman, another adept, you know.
Yeah, and that kind of freedom that you had to sort of explore, like you say, these exceptions to like what we thought of as the rules of the setting, that I guess harkens back to Rogue Traders, I suppose, were like an early example of that, because the way that the Rogue Trader characters are kind of designed are that they have a lot of freedom to kind of be everywhere and do everything. But even though it's something that I feel like, on the one hand, it feels like something that's designed to enable the game to happen, it also makes the world more interesting. And I think being able to do both those things is a real kind of, when you get it right, it's such a addition to the game, I think.
Yeah, I think, well, that was it. I think that was, you know, the scale of the models, but also the character of the models, the style of the models. Although, you know, they were designed by, you know, six or seven different sculptors, I think, in the end. But each one was considered, you know, although there would be, in the end, it's like each one had to be a character, had to be a personality. And although there might be some extra spare bits that were available later on to like swap the guns or put a different head on or slightly tweak stuff, again, this was very much, it was for people that already knew how to do modelling and things. There was no introductory element about it, I guess.
Yes.
Which, again, was quite freeing. You know, go back to sort of like the idea of generations and start sets and stuff. We didn't have to explain to people about what modelling was or what converting models were, because this wasn't a game that was going to get marketed to people just walking into Games Workshop for the first time.
Definitely not, no.
And in fact, it kind of went too far the other way. It was almost not marketed at all. But yeah, that idea of of creating your own characters out of these pieces. So here's everything we did was an example. This example, here's three example Inquisitors, one a radical, one a Puritan, one a witch hunter Puritan in power armor, which are kind of like the three examples we had. So we had, you know, like the very obviously kind of traditional Inquisitor as been portrayed in 14,000, which was witch hunter Tyrus. Then we had kind of fairly Jess Goodwin's Covenant, Inquisitor Covenant model, who was kind of much more, he was actually younger, but again, slightly more, I would say, idealistic. And then we had Eisenhorn, which was kind of based off this kind of more John Blanchy type stuff, which was like, you know, beaten down, started to, you know, it's like almost world weary kind of defender of, and his body is almost broken down and stuff, but he's still fighting the good fight. But actually, people think he's gone to the other side and stuff. So, you know, there were three kind of hits that we wanted, and they kind of, and it's interesting which ones people kind of associated with them. There was always, it didn't seem to be anybody that just went, oh, I don't like any of them. I mean, people made up their own things, but just as three archetypes, they, you know, there were still the witch hunter Tyrus types of people that just wanted to be all fire and brimstone, imperial. So they didn't, not that it was easy, but just it wasn't a leap they were to kind of create that kind of character in Warband. And so we had a kind of a pseudo redemptionist kind of crazy guy. Acolyte for that could, again, any of them could go with any of them, depending on the backstory and stuff. But also, if they wanted to, they kind of fell neatly into nice, easy to collect war bands as well. If people wanted to theme stuff straight out of the boxes, so yeah. But the thing is, these, you know, I think all of that then, like I say, had a profound effect on quite a lot of 40K for the last 20 years in terms of stuff being directly influenced, you know, like, you know, the 40K RPG being Deathwatch, you know, for a long time. And then, like I said, there is a Deathwatch army now, Arcoflagellants and Sisters Penitent and stuff like that have all ended up in the Sisters of Battle army. And all that kind of stuff. So stuff has actually become mainstream, which I don't mind. It's added that craziness into 40K, I think, which is cool.
Yeah. And the way these Space Marines are growing, they'll be similar size to, you know, Inquisitor scale soon.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I think Artemis would be able to have a bit of competition. But one of the interesting things, actually, because when we were making it, there wasn't any model. So I was converting up, or lots of people were converting up cool stuff. And I was doing a lot of modeling with like 1/35 scale kind of World War II troops and that kind of stuff. But what I found was the 40K orc weapons were great for that scale anyway, because 40K is slightly oversized, even at 32 or 40, 28 mil and stuff. Actually, a lot of the weapons, particularly heavy weapons and stuff, you know, I just used a heavy bolter and it worked as a bolter. And that kind of stuff for a lot of the original playtest models. And so actually that was one of the things, funnily enough, I think, you know, Jed's got to do a Space Marine at 50 more, so he got to do a more kind of like true scale kind of proportioned Space Marine. And I think that's probably, you know, again, all that way later, the Primaris, him being able to do that in 40K scale, of him going back to the basic outline of the Space Marine and not changing anything, but just proportioning it slightly differently. And in this case, making it, you know, slightly taller. And suddenly he's got a Space Marine, which just, you know, it's amazing the difference, because it's not a massive change, but actually just small tweaks here and there. But there's elements of Artemis, the 54mm model, in there that he did, because he had to do that work of like, you can't just scale up a 28mm model to 54mm scale, because they just look clownish. Big hands, big feet, you know, everything just doesn't quite work, because there's a skill to making, it's like cartoonish almost, which works at 28mm scale, doesn't work when you just make it bigger. You know, it was only around really for a couple of years, but people still talk about it, play it, you know.
And that's the other side of its legacy is, I guess, this whole, you know, Inc. 28 movement that's going on.
Yes, absolutely. Like I say, I suppose the idea of reintroducing narrative wargaming to a whole bunch of people and doing it, like I say, in the 41st millennium. And so, yeah, I think, and for the crazy modelers and role players out there and stuff who just want to make up cool stuff and see it on the table and don't have to worry too much about what it's going to count as, or, you know, that sort of thing, it's still there. And I think, and, you know, John Blanche, you know, and the whole kind of Blanche issue thing it was a kind of a resurrection of a lot of those ideas and craziness of Inquisitor and the group he plays with. You know, it's descended from that stuff. And there's a guy called David Fincher, who's great. I mean, he knows more about Inquisitor than I do, because he's been still playing it 20 years later. I've not played it for 18 years, you know, or whatever, and stuff. And he's been organising Inquisitor events at Warhammer World and things. And I went down to one in London that he had done, and it was great. And he's built like Inquisitor scale Rhino, and you know, and he's got like dozens of models he's made. So these people, you know, are out there influenced and excited still by that game 20 years on, without any encouragement even. That's the thing, you know. It's still rolling on its own. And I think that's the, like the role playing, I guess. It doesn't need too much, because it's all about the players having the ability to choose what they do and how they want to play and the characters they create. It doesn't need a central control. You know, it doesn't need official updates. It doesn't. The thing people always ask for is models. You know, they just want parts. They want bits. They want. That's the best service we could have done. And I just think now, like, you know, the plastics technology and output of Games Workshop now doing Inquisitor, so that we weren't just making 15 bespoke models, but actually 15 bespoke kits. Without necessarily draining away the character that went into them, but just, so it's, you know, but just being able to make 5 different head variants and 5 different gun variants rather than 2 or 3. So each one would still be Eisenhorn, would still be Covenant, would still be Tyrus, would still be whoever, you know, Severina and Savora, the Death Cultists, whatever. But actually just modelling, making it easier for people to model. Because I think that was the... between that and Terrain, I think Terrain was the biggest complaint, really. There was little double, you know, it's like, modelling's cool, because you can make a bunch of models and convert and stuff, but actually trying to model whole battlefields in 54mm, and they can only be used in 54mm, and because you want lots of different environments and exciting places to fight and stuff, I think that was one of the things that made Inc. 28 or the Incremunda stuff much more manageable, not just the miniatures, but actually the tabletops.
Yeah, definitely. I can see that.
So I think that, again, was something we would be able to address maybe slightly differently now, with different kind of like plastic technologies and resin and whatever else, you know, or MDF terrain and all that kind of stuff that's out there now. There's a lot
more
flexible 20 years on. So, you know, I think, you know, as much as you can't go back and do things again, it's like, I'd love to have a go. You know, I don't want to go back and work against Workshop and that, all that kind of stuff. But actually, had I had then what resources there are now, we could have made something even more amazing, I think.
Sure. You know, I think the thing that it really, I for full disclosure, I'm holding a copy of Inquisitor here now, but I've not actually played Inquisitor itself.
Right. Yeah.
But the whole sort of Ink 28 thing is what sort of got me back into the idea of miniatures after about 15 years of hiatus of just playing role playing games and things. And I think it is that thing where it reframed what miniatures were as part of the game, because I think for the majority of people, the miniatures themselves are what originally got us excited about playing a war game. Like when we first saw like all the miniatures laid out, I'm sure there were some people that got excited about dice mechanics and things. and I did get excited about them as well, but it was secondary to the initial hit of those miniatures. And I think, like you say, being able to just put together a miniature and not necessarily worry about, well, what's this going to be? Am I starting an army of this, or does this need to be a certain way? You can just cobble together something. And then you can kind of find a place for it in this setting and in this kind of tone. And the rules are kind of almost secondary to some sides of that kind of Ink 28 corner. It is much more about the modeling, the game serving the modeling almost, I guess.
Yes.
It was interesting to see how it kind of reframed the idea of miniatures for me, because I kind of didn't get the whole 54mm scale at the time. But now I see that having that extra, being able to really zoom in on that, it allowed you to have these miniatures that had so much more character. And like you said about the exceptional thing, where they were all kind of, this isn't just a space marine. This is a specific space marine that's had this specific background, this specific experience, and it kind of tells a story.
Yes, yeah. And hopefully serves as inspiration, I suppose. Because that's the main thing, was to inspire, we had to inspire people. And one of the things I liked about Inquisitor is the colour section in it, because normally, like a Codex or a Warhammer Army book would have a colour section in it, which would show you the painted toy soldiers, and they're all painted beautifully by the heavy metal team, and they're all ranked up, and there'd be battle shots and stuff. And we had all of that, but there, because it was all about modelling and painting your own stuff, there's a whole section. It's just full of other people's models.
Yeah, I love that.
And they were hobbyist models, and actually some of them, they're not painted to everything. You know, it's got my models in there. I'm not an heavy metal painted standard. You know, I did my best. And actually, you can do some stuff at 54 mil that works quite well. As short, you know, again, it's like these days with contrast paints, you're like, ooh, actually, there'd be some really good stuff you could do. But it was meant to show how approachable it was. You know, there was stuff by Ali Morrison who did this kind of amazing, use a Warhammer giant to make an ogre. And you're like, yeah, that's the real aspirational stuff. And then there's stuff that, you know, the guy from the production studio who was in charge of the, you know, the layout team had cobbled together out some models and things like that. And it went the whole spectrum, you know, from,
yeah, definitely.
And they're all nice, you know, it's like, but also there was stuff that, you know, we showed kind of bare models without being painted and that kind of stuff. And it was real, I suppose. Like I said, that authenticity that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, 100%.
And we were into, you know, and Graham McNeil and Phil Kelly, particularly, who were on the 40K team at the time, helped a lot as well. You know, they were really running with it, because they're role players, you know, big time role players and stuff as well. Mm. So they were running a campaign for me, so I could actually concentrate on like the game side and stuff. But actually, they were running loads of games and all the rest of it. So that really helped. There was a real buzz around the studios of like, people didn't necessarily always play it, but again, they'd dig out of, they'd get one of the models that came through as a test piece, or they'd get some other 40K thing. And I remember Adrian Woods, you know, all crazy kind of like conversions of robots and killbots and all this kind of, and it was all in there. And they were just like, and it just had a little, you know, each only had like 50 words about it, or even just a picture and a caption stuff. But it was there. It was just like, look, you can go and just make stuff, and isn't it fun? And we tried to, you know, we never quite followed that up in White Dwarf. There was a lot of kind of rules and backgroundy stuff, but never quite. And we did some cool battle reports and things, but we never quite hit the hobby side of it, I think. Again, and that was a shame. But, you know, there was a slight hesitancy to showing non-top standard kind of miniatures and stuff. Which, of course, we did in the battle reports, actually. We were using our own. That was one of the things why people liked a lot of the battle reports. Again, they were using our own models. People love 100%. To see that sometimes, you know, rather than just seeing the same armies, particularly at the time, seeing the same armies from the heavy metal shelves again and again. So, yeah. But the Inquid 28, and that is great, I think, because, again, one of the things it does, you know, converting 28mm models is a lot easier, especially with plastics and things these days.
Sure.
Yeah, it allows you to lots of ideas. I think, and that's what's reassuring, is that, because when we released Inquisitor, you know, one of the things about it being 54mm is people can't just pick up their Space Marine army and put it in the game.
But
people haven't tried to do it particularly, I don't think. And, you know, people get the idea that actually this is something else. This isn't just, you know, your regular 40K miniatures transposed into a setting where you just try and make them all as hard as possible and win whenever you can.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work that way.
I can see the danger of that. If you had just gone with 28mm at the time, then, like you say, yeah, you would have ended up with Marnius Calgar in every, you know, everyone's Inquisitor game, which doesn't quite fit.
No, absolutely not. And there were a few models that just, you know, I think some of the stuff that came out Fanatic was a little bit on the nose. It was just like, you know, a pure strain gene stealer, and there was a beautifully modern sculpted Eldar Ranger, but he was just an Eldar Ranger. There was, you know, they had backstory and stuff which made it different, but the miniatures needed something else. There was some really cool, unique stuff as well that came out from Fanatic and things, and the Tau Watercast model and stuff like that. But yeah, I think, as a concept, like I say, that idea is still there of people making models and telling stories on the tabletop and rolling dice is, that's why, yeah, Inquisitor is one of my important games, I guess.
I could keep talking to you about Inquisitor for much longer, but I'm aware that we've smashed the usual time limit, I'm making an exception for Inquisitor. Yeah. following that exception.
Well, yeah, again. I mean, we haven't even gone on to about, you know, lots of other skirmish games of certain creators. Oh.
I might have to try and ask you to come back again on a future series.
I'm happy to do that, definitely.
But unfortunately, as much as it pains me to do so, I am going to unfortunately have to move on to... This sounds like a terrible... Like I'm pushing you towards some terrible pick, and I will apologise to the author of this next game personally. But what is your third pick?
So the third one is a really odd one, but it is Goblin Quest by Grant Howitt.
Great. And I'm sorry, Grant, about saying that your game is unfortunate. But I'm glad it was you that I was able to say that about, because I'm sure Grant will understand.
Yes, I'm sure.
So, yeah, what's the story behind Goblin Quest for those that don't know it?
Right, okay. So, context. So, I'm addicted to Kickstarter, right? I've got a terrible Kickstarter habit. And I've got a few of the really big ones, big kind of Kickstarter games with, like, large, you know, like hundreds of dollars of stuff. But not necessarily the ones that most people back, but a couple of the older ones like Cthulhu Wars and things. And also I get quite a few graphic novels and things from from Kickstarter and stuff like that as well. And one of the things I love about Kickstarter is it's just like, it's a good, you know, it's a way of stuff that wouldn't necessarily be commercially viable on a bigger scale, still being made. You know, I love that idea of just, you know, somebody being able to have like 200 backers and make a thing because it's scaled to that level, and they're not trying to put it. You know, some people are trying to fund retail products and all that kind of stuff, which is cool, and I back some of those as well. But I also just love finding small things, and most of that's come about because of Goblin Quest. So Goblin Quest was on Kickstarter. And it just came up as a recommend or whatever on my feed. And I looked at it and I went, well, that looks fun. And it reminds me of a game that I really wanted to play, a card game, which was Fantasy Flight, I think I've still got, which is called I, Dark Overlord. Which is where you have one dark player as a Dark Overlord and the other players are all goblins trying to blame each other basically for why they failed their mission. And they play various... There's two versions. It's kind of like a slightly crunchy card game in there, but there's also just like a storytelling game that's kind of guided by the cards. And I always wanted to try and play the storytelling game and never quite did it. I kept taking it to conventions and Black Library events and stuff and trying to get five or six people together and never quite worked. And so Goblin Quest is essentially kind of the same idea of like you're playing slightly rubbish goblins and you're trying to achieve something. And it might be just, it reminded me of sort of like early RPG quests, like video RPG quests, where you have to go and fetch a chair from somebody or do something really low level, because your characters aren't very, you know, tough or anything. And essentially, you have, you know, you represent a bunch of goblins, and there's an element of the like paranoia style. You will lose some of your goblins on the way, kind of thing. And it's just good fun. But it wasn't necessarily Goblin Quest itself that was important, but the fact that it then put me on to Grant Howitt. He then asked me just to contribute a little bit to his next game, which is called Unbound, which was, again, it's just kind of very action-orientated sort of role-playing game stuff, but it has a thing in there called Touchstone. So they're just, it's like these ideas tables, which I contributed one of those to it. But then after that, around about the same time, he was working on Spire, which is a phenomenal looking game, just the art for it and the idea and stuff, and again the leaps from kind of like 40k madness and all that kind of stuff. So I loved it, so I ended up back in Spire, and also Heart, which is follow up. But essentially, all of this has led me back into role playing games, is the short version, I suppose. But particularly very indie, slightly smaller games, I guess. You know, for the beautiful production quality and stuff from Grant and the folks there, you know, this isn't like Chaosium or TSR or that kind of stuff. It's like, you know, but that's also led me further down into the zines, which is great. And actually, we've got Zine Quest on at the moment, and I've just gone insane. And I've backed, you know, I don't know, 12 different things, and including like solo RPGs and all this kind of, essentially, Goblin Quest has got me back into role playing. and combined with the timely release from EM Publishing of the new Judge Dredd role-playing game. I'm a big 2000 AD fan, so I just had to pick that up. And I'm actually running a campaign with some friends now. So that's actually physically. But just I'm just excited. Like, and the Zine Quest and the Zines idea and lots of these indie games. And I've been doing a few little bits and pieces for various creators. And I'm just dead jealous because it has got that Inquisitor-style freedom of creation about it. You know, most of my games design is quite restricted. Most of it was at Games Workshop. So it was like within, you know, and it was fun and I enjoyed it. And I'm pleased with what I did. But obviously, it was within, as I mentioned earlier, it's on the shoulders of giants and within established IP and all sorts of other constraints. So, whereas I love that kind of that indie feel that it's in a lot. There's kind of two levels. To role playing, and I'm really enjoying just the freedom of ideas and stuff that's kind of bubbling out and being expressed at the moment, and want to be part of it. You know, it's like I say, I've been fortunate enough that my name has kind of got me contacted by a couple of creators who've asked me to just contribute like an alternative setting, or can you just do, can you write a little bit about for this game or that kind of thing? Can you write me an adventure as a stretch goal and stuff? And it's been really fun. I don't know if I would have contacted that in a different way if it hadn't been. So, you know, Goblin Quest started that path, if you see what I mean, down. I say down, I don't mean like,
into the depths.
Into the underbelly, it's almost that feel again, though. It is like there's, you know, we all know there's D&D and Critical Role and lots of cool stuff happening there, and it's all very exciting. And that's the Games Workshop of role playing, and they're going to just make lots of money. And that's what most people get recruited into and stuff like that. But there's the people that filter down into other stuff. They become creators later and all the rest of it and stuff. And there's like a second tier of stuff that's been around a long time, like Call of Cthulhu and RuneQuest and certain other ones. And I'm never quite sure, One Fantasy Roleplay, getting very popular and ongoing and all that stuff. And, I'm never quite sure how big those businesses are really and all the rest of it stuff. They're certainly not tier, they're not D&D size, but they're certainly a step above, the person churning out 50 copies of their zine for Dragon Con or whatever. But the thing about the zines in particular that I like is they remind me of miniatures gaming in the 70s and 80s. Now, I didn't really do it, obviously, any gaming in the 70s. I'm not quite that old. But actually, things like the Wild West skirmish game, the fact that you could just like have basically 10 stapled pages folded over, and that constituted a war game, and the ideas and the content being more important than the presentation. And the presentation of these is amazing as well. I'm not trying to make it a backhanded compliment, but actually the combination of those two things, these days you can, with desktop publishing, digital printing, you can do amazing stuff. And the freelance artists and sculptors and everything out there, as an industry, it's never been a better time to be a creator as well. But also actually just that, with the best intention in the world, that down and dirty, just getting some ideas on a page and actually getting it printed out there for, like I say, 200 people or whatever it might be. I love that idea as well. These are the guys that used to go around all the war game shows and would have their set of, this is their set of rules for recreating a particular campaign from 1784 between such and such and such and such. They'd be running their demo games and you'd be able to, for £2 you could buy the rules off them. And I love that part of the hobby as much as I love, as much as I love the big kind of glitzy, hardback books and, all the rest of it. So, yeah.
You've kind of got all of that. All of that is kind of combined within what Grant does. So,
that's a nice medium, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah. So he does these with Chris Taylor. He does like the one page, they're like monthly one page games.
Yes.
But then on the other side, you've got something like Spire, which I would say is a nicer looking book than pretty much anything that was produced in like the 80s, I guess.
Oh no, absolutely, yes.
So I mean, obviously, it's a different time, certainly, but the fact that a small team of Rowan, Rook, and Deckard being three people, the fact that a small team can do both those things is kind of sums up the two ends of the hobby at the moment in that kind of underbelly.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting, and again, I've backed a couple of these also with the Zine Quest and things like that. Another one that I did early on was like Kobolds Ate My Baby, which again was actually a second edition through Kickstarter. So again, it was a community zine type thing, but actually had enough goodwill, I suppose, and interest and stuff that they felt confident they could maybe take it to Kickstarter and do a slightly more polished hardback, little hardback version of it. And there's various other, you know, we see this iterative process now. So stuff will come out and it is almost, you know, yeah, it's, you know, when, like I say, the Grants One Page things are literally handwritten, you know, and things like that with little sketches in the corners and stuff. And there's that level, but actually there's also people who are getting something like Kickstarter, then allowing them to go back to those ideas and say, well, actually the ideas are cool, but I want to do this as a slightly better book. And a digitally print. And again, it's like, you know, you're not looking at thousands and thousands of copies, and it's not going to be necessarily a massive hardback, but actually looking at, you know, stuff like working on I did a little bit for an adventure for the second edition of Best Left Buried. And I've done there's Lost Fleet is another one I've did a alternative background for, and various other, and so again, these aren't the photocopied given out at conventions, but this is a step up in terms of quality, but also polish, and being able to do, you know, just the concept of individual creators being able to access that pool of talent that's out there now in terms of like artists, editors, layout, that kind of stuff. You don't need a studio permanently running for you now. Again, although you might need some serious scheduling and kind of like project management skills to kind of pull it off if you're working with like freelance and things, and building up, you know, an audience for your thing.
If you're one of these annoying people that can draw as well as write and, you know, learn a little bit of layout software, you can kind of do it all, like, absolutely, to some extent. And it's going to be completely different to what a one person operation looked like in, you know, 1981 rather than 2021.
Absolutely. And I think, and there's a certain amount of that as well. There's a bit of that kind of punk sensibility coming in, and the idea, again, some of it reminds me, not just visually, but as concept of like the like underground kind of punk music magazine, zines, and that zine idea.
Yeah, definitely.
I think being resurrected is cool. You know, it's the ideas the man didn't want you to see, or whatever it might be. But now we have a great digital network that actually allows those to share, rather than, you know, somebody hanging out outside a pub in Camden or whatever, physically give you a copy, or basically sending yourself, you know, stamped self-addressed envelope off to some place that you've seen in the back of a games magazine or music magazine or whatever, and getting it and then subscribing to this, you know, this magazine that comes out every, you know, 6 months or whatever, if they actually ever hit their deadlines, kind of thing.
These are the games that Hasbro doesn't want you to know exist.
Yeah, absolutely. As a creator, I find that that's what inspiring and invigorating, and I'm jealous of it, and in a good way. You know, it's like, oh, actually, yeah, I want to do some of this. This is getting back. This reminds me of work. Inquisitor, but more importantly, this reminds me of, you know, when I was, you know, as much as Dungeons and Dragons and this basic set reminds me of when I was 12, actually just going back and making up stuff and creating stuff for the fun of it. You know, I've had a whole career of doing it professionally and with some of the best in the world in terms of artists and sculptors and stuff. So I am blessed, and I've had, you know, the informal and formal training that I had to do that. But actually just going a bit punk on it and just going a bit kind of like, it doesn't matter if it's a little bit shonky, but in a good way, it doesn't have to be polished to the nth degree, which is where I am professionally. And it doesn't have to have that massive support network around it. Cause the one thing that I had, particularly when I left Games Workshop, the projects worked and stuff, there was no chance of them failing. There was no risk, and they didn't push stuff and try and do the best they were and stuff, but it was part of this massive organization and retail chain and everything else. So there was no, you know, it's like, and I get things wrong and be personally criticized, but actually I didn't have much stake in it, I guess.
Yeah.
And it's slightly different when you write a novel. So all my novel writing stuff, there's always a little bit more risk of will people read it, what they're going to like, you know, that kind of stuff. But again, most of that has been under the aegis of, you know, the Black Library and stuff. So again, fairly safe waters for me. And and most of my games design stuff has been, again, in fairly established ways. I, you know, worked with Andy Chambers again to do Strontium Dog for Warlord. And I've done, like background sections for, TT Combat and various other things, but I would really quite like to do work on something that I'll just put myself out there, and it's risky, and not like, you know, I'm not betting the house on it or anything like that, you know, and stuff, but creatively and emotionally risky, I suppose. That's one of the things I'm trying to get towards, and that's possible at that level, at that zine and kind of slightly above level. You can do that because it is accessible and because it's, you're not trying to make it, you're trying to make it creatively successful and as commercially successful as it needs to be, rather than more than, I guess. And
but that needs to create a an anonymous kind of undercover pseudonym and just release some shonky zine in Zine Quest next year.
Yeah, well, absolutely, yes. And then if it doesn't do very well, then I'll just put my proper name on it, and then
that's it.
Cheat. And then just just
revised edition.
Yeah, revised edition. And this is actually me. I'll endorse it.
That's it.
Henry B. Buttersworth is a fantastic role-playing designer.
I'm going to look through the names of your Inquisitor Warband in this book and memorize them to see if you reuse them.
Yeah. But that's, yes, so that's, and so that's why Goblin Quest was important, I guess, was not in and of itself, but just doing for me, for modern war games and the modern war game scene, what that basic set of D&D did I was 11 or 12, you know, just thinking, oh, this is awesome. I want to be part of this, I guess.
Thank you for sharing your three choices. I'm just looking over them now. And are there any like honorable mentions that you wanted to slip in before we finish?
The Adeptus Titanicus and Epic Space Marine from Games Workshop were the ones that I played the most when I was before. And I had a bit of a Warhammer army, and I sort of had a 40k army, but I had proper army, and we played nearly every week at Epic.
Ah, cool.
And so that was the real game that I played. So that was very important to me, and it was nice to work on a couple of later editions of that, I suppose. I would also say, funnily enough, going back to kind of introductions, there was and goblins. There's a game called Goblin, which was like a very simple hex war game that I had again around about that same time, so early 80s. And one player is goblins, and you come down into, and it's very just kind of medieval feudal kind of setting. You just kind of come down into the valley and you raid, and then the other person is like the prince and the knights trying to defend it. But again, that was kind of like my first bedding into that idea of hex war games and that the possibilities of that, which again got explored in other directions later in life and stuff. So that was important. But also, you know, things like the Strontium Dog game that I just worked on with Andy Chambers, because it was a chance to work with Andy again. So that was important. Actually, it's been nice to reconnect professionally and personally with Andy over that project. You know, so that's, you know, I think that's been an important one for me as well.
That actually brings me to, I did say at the start that I had one self-indulgent question, and I apologize for this. You can veto this question if you so wish.
Sure.
I've mentioned before that my own history with sort of getting into Games Workshop when I was sort of about 10 years old. My sort of first exposure was a boy in the older year at school bringing in his... I think it was probably Warhammer 40,000 at the time, miniatures for like show and tell.
Right.
And this kind of being my first exposure to it, and it sort of blew my mind. Again, sounding like an old man, but in like a pre-internet age, this was like, I'd not seen anything like this stuff. Like, yeah. I'd seen like toy soldiers, but this was a completely different thing. So on the next day, with my pocket money, I went and bought the current issue of White Dwarf from the newsagents, which was, I'm sure you'll remember it well, White Dwarf 187, June 1995.
Right.
And this was like my first exposure. And I remember just like absorbing every single, because this was my entire library at the moment of yeah. what I had. So there was no Games Workshop near me. So I just had to like absorb everything in this magazine. And the battle report in there was called Heretic.
It was a good one to start with.
Yeah. So it was a big tank battle. So for all I knew, this was like the standard, because this is my first battle report.
Yeah, yeah. Wow.
So I'm like, this is just what they do, is it? Like you just get 30 tanks on each side.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And yeah, those images are very strongly burned in my brain, including Andy Chambers with a very extravagant red shirt and sunglasses indoors.
Yes.
And obviously yourself, you were, I believe you were the Ultramarine Commander. I have checked this up. I didn't memorize it to that degree. But but my self-indulgent question is that was kind of a bit of a big deal at the time, that battle report. It was a slightly different sort of scale, and it was quite different to what was going on with the battle reports at the time. So do you remember much about that particular one?
Yeah, absolutely. No, that was a fantastic battle report. Like you say, that was another Jervis idea actually. It was like, which is kind of almost a precursor to like later, like Big Games of Apocalypse and stuff like that, which was let's get all our tanks and have a game with them, which was the simple idea. And we'll have a multiplayer and we'll do it as a battle report. So it's like we'll have all the Imperial Guard tanks on one side and we'll have all the Space Marine tanks on the other side. And then to make it more fun, we'll have one overall commander and three sub-commanders generally. I think that's the way it worked.
Yeah.
And the players can't talk to each other except by recording messages on a dictaphone. Mm. So we had a shared dictaphone, which was basically the radio, but it was an open radio. So basically you could take the dictaphone and you could record something, but basically it would all get played at the end of, or before the next turn. So you could hear both sides' messages.
Right.
So, and what was fun, and I can't remember if we explained this, this was probably explained in the battle report, but what I can't remember if we explained in the conclusions, that basically Andy, and he was in charge of a new batch of assistant games developers at the time. So, and they came up with some kind of, well, I say sophisticated, but it seemed sophisticated at the time, kind of code system, I think, which is like, if it was preceded by a color, then it was a true transmission. And if it wasn't preceded by a color, then it was a false transmission. So they'd be saying things like green four, da, 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 do this, do that, do this. I need support over here, kind of stuff. And then they would say like, you know, like, oh, Romeo six. And then obviously that'd be a fake transmission.
I'm gonna right, right.
Frank. Being amazing Space Marines, our side, me, Ian, was it Jervis? Come on, Mark, maybe. We just came up with a plan and said all of our transmissions are fake, and that's the way we did it. So we just did our plan, executed it, because we were like, we had a flying wedge thing which was kind of based on German World War II Panzer tactics and this, that, and the other. And we came up with this basic strategy, and then each of us was essentially would react as needed to the situation on the ground, and anything on the Vox was to be disregarded. So that was it, really. Which is just, you know, which we that just that that to do different approaches really was quite fun, you know. But yeah, that battle report is one, you know, like again, that's a bit of a hero quest for some people. There was a slightly earlier one we'd done for Warhammer called Gathering of Might, which was another big multiplayer battle report. But yeah, definitely. One of those that 20 years later, it's people still.
It had a real like narrative.
Yeah, the evil Lord Varlak.
Yes, that was it.
Which is great. Who's still in 40K.
Nice.
And again, some great text written by Andy, actually, channeling his inner supervillain. Yeah. Because you know, evil Lord Varlak's power was he could control the minds of everyone nearby. And so there was just a bit about some Inquisitor coming and spoiling all his fun and poking their nose in where they're not wanted and stuff. And then sounds of dumb acquiescent nodding in the background or something like that. Just like we can just imagine all these command staff just nodding vacantly because he's basically controlling them. And then he ended up getting chased down by a landspeeder and multi-melted.
Yes, that's it.
Because he had to try and escape the table. He was in a bunker in the middle and had to escape, didn't he?
Yeah. But I think those pictures, I mean, they're fun to look back on now because they are very 1990s, but those like pictures of people around the table playing, it sounds dead obvious, but I think those did a lot to get me really locked in to the hobby as someone who, like I said, I couldn't go to a Games Workshop because it was too far away.
Yeah.
And I didn't have like a local group or anything like that. So it allowed you to kind of feel involved because it feels like a more real thing rather than just reading these articles. Yeah, for those first few issues of White Dwarf, I think they're kind of instrumental in making it feel a bit more real to people.
Yeah, it was the same for me. I mean, slightly earlier, but the same idea of just seeing Andy and Jervis playing an epic battle report.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they're writing their introductions, and it's kind of like, cool, there's got some strategy and stuff. But it's just like, no, this is people playing a game.
Yeah.
People actually play this game. You're like, oh, right, maybe I could play this game. and then later to get to work with them was amazing. But, it's interesting, like I say, that being able to portray a sense of community before there was the internet was a very different thing.
I guess streaming is like the equivalent now. I guess it was almost like before I could play the game. It's like that there's so many people that I hear of that sort of watch D&D streams but don't really play RPGs. And I guess a parallel to that. Well, thanks so much for coming on and sharing your choices with us. And thank you for tolerating my self-indulgent question.
That was a great question. Love it.
If people want to find out more about what you're up to, where can they go?
Okay, right. Well, you can go to my website, but that's not been updated for quite a while. But that's www.gavthorpe.co.uk. I blather about on Twitter quite a lot, which is at GavthorpeCreate. And if they should wish to do so, I'm actually on Patreon for $1/pound a month. That's the one tier pledge level. And I just usually put 2 or 3 things up a month if I can get around to it. And that's on Gavthorpe Writes Stuff.
Cool.
So that's the best places. Yeah. The best way of getting hold of me is via either Twitter or on the website as a contact form.
It's great stuff. Cool. So thank you again to Gav for joining me, and thank you for listening. As always, you can keep up to date with everything Bastionland at bastionland.com, where there are links to the Discord server, Twitch and YouTube channels, and to Patreon, where you can help support this podcast. And you can join me next week, where I'll be welcoming another guest to distill their gaming history into the Rule of Three. Goodbye for now.